Good morning. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals today. We're glad you're here. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief of the Court. And I understand everybody's here. They've checked in, and they're ready to go. Before we begin, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Andrew Gould for the appellant, Demetrius Grant. Given the basic facts, reasonably disputed that the injuries that occurred to Mr. Grant were the result of negligence at WTEC's facility. The question before this court is whether, as a matter of law on summary judgment, the appellees were entitled to evade legal liability for common law negligence. And the answer to that question is no, and the district court erred in holding otherwise. First, genuine issues of material fact exist as to WTEC's right to control Mr. Grant, raising a question about whether Mr. Grant was in fact their borrowed employee. And second, as to Aero, genuine issues of material fact exist as to the elements of traditional negligence, which can apply because Aero is a non-subscriber to workers' compensation. I plan in my remarks to focus just on the main issues with respect to the two grants of summary judgment. And I'd actually like to begin first by discussing Aero, and then I'll discuss WTEC. It's important to understand Mr. Grant's theory of liability against Aero. Mr. Grant has always said that Aero, as his employer, failed to provide a reasonably safe workplace, including failure to train him and failure to supervise.
Did Aero have any knowledge about WTEC being some unreasonably dangerous workplace, and yet they kept sending people there to work?
Your Honor, there's no direct evidence to that. There's circumstantial evidence to that. So the circumstantial evidence that we would point to is Mr. Grant's testimony, and this is at Clerk's Record 888, talking about the many safety incidents that occurred at WTEC. We would also point to Mr. Bracey, who is not not an Aero employee. He worked for a different agency and eventually for WTEC, where he testified, and this is at Clerk's Record 1172, that WTEC wasn't a place that cared about safety and welfare. Now, again, although there's nothing in the record that directly says that that Aero knew about that, they had a relationship together. And they set up a relationship, an employment relationship, a staffing agency with an employer. And so, taking all reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to Mr. Grant, a reasonable juror could conclude that they should have known about what occurred. And this goes back to kind of Aero's status again as Mr. Grant's employer. They owed him a non-delegable duty to provide a reasonably safe workplace. And part of providing a reasonably safe workplace includes proper supervision and training that comes from the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Farley versus M.M. Cattle. Now, what Aero says is that, well, essentially they say, well, because once he entered the four corners of WTEC's facility, you know, WTEC alone controlled him, and they controlled his work. Now, we dispute that, and we've explained why, but even taking that to be true, they still owed him non-delegable duties. Aero focuses on the right to control cases, such as from the Supreme Court's recent opinion in Waste Management versus Stevenson. The problem with that is that the right to control is relevant when it comes to the workers' compensation bar. So, for example, in Waste Management versus Stevenson, Mr. Stevenson didn't sue the staffing agency. He sued Waste Management, the company he was employed to. And that's why the right to control mattered, because the right to control mattered because Waste Management, which was a subscriber to workers' compensation, said that was his exclusive remedy. That's not this case, because again, Aero is a non-subscriber. And so Aero talks about, well, WTEC was his immediate employer. And it cites the Northern District of Texas's opinion in Parham. But I'd urge the court to look carefully at that opinion, because assuming that opinion, which of course does not bind this court, but assuming this court were to find it persuasive, what Parham discusses is how the plaintiff worked for Ryder Integrated Logistics, but he was suing Ryder System Incorporated. And so while there was a question of fact about whether there was an employment relationship between Mr. Parham and Ryder System, that was not his immediate employer. That's not this case. Mr. Grant's immediate employer was Aero. Aero hired him. Aero paid him. Aero alone had the right to terminate him. They were his immediate employer. And so separate and apart from the duties that WTEC owed to Mr. Grant, Aero owed certain non-delegable duties. And again, that's what we've emphasized in our opening brief and our reply brief. These are non-delegable duties. And with respect to that, genuine issues of material fact exist as to all the elements. I've just discussed the duty element.
Excuse me, let me interrupt you with another question. Are there any cases out there where someone has successfully sued their staffing agency for an on-the-job accident at some place that they were sent?
I'm not aware, Your Honor. Most of the cases that I've seen, for example, the Waste Management versus Stevenson, the Wingfoot versus Alvarado, Garza versus Excel, I'm talking about kind of the progeny of Supreme Court cases involving a staffing agency and the employer. That involves a situation in which the staffing agency is a subscriber to workers' compensation, and the employer that the plaintiff tries to sue is also a subscriber. That's what makes this case unique. And so I was unable to find any cases involving that unique situation. If Aero was a subscriber to workers' compensation, Mr. Grant might not be here today. And in fact, Aero was, per their contract, was supposed to provide workers' compensation, but they didn't. And that carries a penalty, which is that they're subject to common law liability. And I'd like to cite, this is from the Wingfoot case. It's discussed in the Waste Management versus Stevenson. If either has elected not to provide coverage, workers' compensation coverage, but still qualifies as an employer under the Act, then that employer should be subject to common law liability without the defenses such as comparative negligence. And that's what we're saying here.
But we would first have to find that Aero and not WTEC controlled what Mr. Grant was doing there.
I don't necessarily think so, Your Honor. So again, we believe, so our position is that there's a genuine issue of material fact as to the right to who had the right to control Mr. Grant's work. And if you look at the language of Stevenson talks about how there's a right to control, that Waste Management had the right to control Mr. Stevenson both as a general matter and as a specific matter as it related to the incident in question.
What evidence is out there that Aero had the right to control the operation of the machinery and where they were located on the premises and all the tasks that the plaintiff was required to perform? Where's the evidence of that?
We don't have any evidence, Your Honor, of that Aero specifically had that Aero specifically was able to control what was going on within WTEC's facility. Again, our argument really more focuses on Aero's independent non-delegable duties. And for example, and this goes back to how they breached this, it's undisputed that they provided him with no training before he entered WTEC's facility. Now they say, well, WTEC is the one that's supposed to provide that training, right? And sure enough, because if you're going to say that there's a joint employment relationship, then both might have some duties. But here again, they didn't provide any training, and that.
But didn't WTEC have him watch like a safety video? And
they did. They did. WTEC did have him watch a safety video. He filled out a questionnaire, a yes/no check mark, and we're not disputing that. But Aero didn't provide any training. Aero didn't provide any supervision. And if that's the case, if this court were to accept that, that would essentially mean that a staffing agency can enter into an employment relationship with an employer without supervising that employee there. The workplace could be the worst place in America, and I'm not saying that about WTEC. I'm just saying as a general matter. And they could say, well, but that's on them. We don't have any liability.
How can a staffing agency train someone to do work at somebody else's facility when they don't have the right to direct and control what happens in that facility or even have any expertise in what it is that goes on in that facility?
Justice Walk, I think while they might not be able to train to the level of specificity, they can still provide general training about workplace safety in general. You know, for example, in preparing for argument, again, I was rereading the progeny of cases in Wingfoot versus Alvarado. Wingfoot was a staffing agency. They were doing business as Tandem. Tandem provided the plaintiff there, their employee, with training. So I'm not necessarily, I agree with you that as to the specific task itself, sure, Aero's maybe not in the best position to provide that training. But as a general matter, as with respect to workplace safety, it could provide some training on that. And again, separate from that, it could supervise. It could supervise him.
How can it supervise? It's not on premises.
Well, so I guess there's two points. One is that it could be on premises. I mean, in other cases, there are staff people from staffing agencies who are on premises, but regardless, they could still keep tabs as to what's going on in the facility in which they're sending their employees.
Is there any case that says they have that duty?
I would say that goes to the duty to supervise. And again, going back to Wingfoot, the staffing agency did have people on site. I'm not saying it's necessarily required, but as part of the non-delegable duty to supervise.
Was that part of a non-delegable duty to supervise, or was that part of the contractual agreement of the parties in that case?
Candidly, I don't know the answer, and I'm happy to look at that and follow up on rebuttal with that question. I apologize that I don't know the answer to that question. But again, I'm not saying that here they were required to have people on site. I'm just saying they could have kept tabs on what was going on.
Well, they could have done a lot of things, but your client needs either some evidence or some law, doesn't he, that Aero had to do those things.
And the law that we would point to, again, is Farley versus MM Cattle, which is that the non-delegable duty to provide training and supervision. And again, I would just go back to the fact that what's different about this case versus the others is that the staffing agency is a non-subscriber, and that's what brings it apart. I've spent the bulk of my time discussing Aero, and I'd like with my remaining time to discuss WTEC. And at summary judgment, and this is true for Aero as well, our burden is to point to more than a scintilla of probative evidence establishing a genuine issue of material fact when you view the facts and the reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to Mr. Grant. And what we point to is what distinguishes this case, say, from the 14th Court's opinion in Webster, that doesn't have the constellation of facts. And returning to the Stevenson opinion with respect to general right to control as a general matter versus a specific matter, here, as a general matter, Aero retained the right to control, or at least a genuine issue of material fact exists as to that. Again, Aero alone had the right to terminate him. WTEC, all WTEC could do was tell Aero, you know, perhaps Mr. Grant's not welcome back in our facility, but they couldn't fire him. That's different from Stevenson, where in Stevenson the testimony was they could, Waste Management could fire Mr. Stevenson. There, again, Mr. Grant was paid by Arrow. Mr. Grant testified that he was supervised by an Arrow employee named Veronica, and when he was asked about who at WTEC was supervising you, he was clear that he wasn't supervised by anybody at WTEC. It was Arrow. Our point here, and
so when someone tells him at WTEC, go to this part of the facility and do this, and their people are back there telling him, stand here, do this, that's not supervision?
It's not. So I don't think it is. I believe that that's a direction, but that's not necessarily supervision. And still the question is, who overall, as an overarching general matter, was his supervisor? Was it somebody at WTEC? WTEC says, well, sure, it was Mr. McCoon, Reuben McCoon.
Or is it the right to direct and control the details of the specific work being done?
As to the specific work being done at the moment in time, it's true that he was directed toward that, but as a general matter, he was not supervised by WTEC, or at least genuine issues of material fact exist. And my time is about to expire, and I'd like to leave with one point, which is we're at summary judgment. I'm not here saying we win as a matter of law, but we have the right to present the case to a jury.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Pruitt.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We all know, as we sit here, that borrowed employee status hinges on who has the right to direct and control the employee. We also all know from the Waste Management versus Stevenson case, April 2021, Texas Supreme Court case, that as a practical matter, it is the course of daily work which determines the right to control. In their brief, the plaintiff tries to argue that WTEC did not have the right to control because it was a temporary staffing agency that hired this employee, and the temporary staffing agency paid him. Well, that has little if nothing to do with control. That's the case in every temporary staffing case. And though there is no, and that is a factor that is cited in the Waste Management case and the four other Texas Supreme Court cases that are cited in our brief. The third thing they try to bring up in their brief is that Arrow made the decision where to assign the plaintiff to go work. Well, that was true. Initially, they made the decision where he's to go work, but they had nothing to do with the decision, daily control of his work details during the 17 consecutive days that he worked at WTEC. That was purely decided by WTEC. Counsel argues that WTEC did not have the right to terminate the plaintiff. That is not accurate. They did have the right to terminate, and I would direct the court to the clerk's record 486, the affidavit of Ricardo Angel, who says clearly that WTEC had the ability to terminate Plaintiff Grant by informing him that he could no longer work at WTEC. What's going on here is they're trying to come up with some reason why, some fact issue, and there simply is none. And I direct the court to our brief, pages 22 and 23. You have 9 specific pieces of evidence that the plaintiff himself testified to as to how WTEC controlled the details of this work. This is indisputable. Piece of evidence number one, how WTEC controlled his work, on the bottom of page 22. Arrow didn't provide this gentleman with any training whatsoever before he went to work at WTEC or after he went to work at WTEC. Piece of evidence number two, when he got to WTEC, WTEC showed him a safety video and gave him a safety quiz. Piece of evidence number three, after he passed the safety quiz, Reuben McCoon, who was a facility manager for the WTEC facility, specifically showed Plaintiff Grant how work was to be performed on the premises. He showed him how steel beams enter the premises from the outside. He showed him how the steel beams are measured and how they're cut. He showed them how the steel beams were moved to the production line. And last but not least, Reuben McCoon showed the plaintiff how the pieces of steel were cut on the production line. In fact, Plaintiff Grant testified that it was his impression that Reuben McCoon, the one who gave him these instructions, was the head guy at WTech. Piece of evidence number five. He, the plaintiff, took instructions from other WTech employees on the premises where to work and how the work was supposed to be done, in addition to Reuben McCoon. Piece of evidence number six. On the day of the accident itself, plaintiff was working in the back of the WTech facility per the instructions given to him by the head man, Reuben McCoon. Piece of evidence number seven. While working for WTech, Grant received his instructions and guidance how to do his job from WTech and its employees, not from the staffing agency, Arrow. Piece of evidence number eight. No one from the staffing agency was present at the WTech facility on the day of the accident or on any other occasion. Piece of evidence number nine. The report of injury form that Plaintiff Grant had his wife complete, and Grant admitted to signing that report of injury form, identified Rick Angel with WTech as his supervisor. The affidavit of Rick Angel is attached to the clerk's record 485 through 487. After looking at all this evidence, these nine pieces of the plaintiff's own testimony, it's clear that there is not a fact question regarding the right of control. This is consistent with the Waste Management versus Stevenson case and the other four or five Supreme Court cases cited in our brief. At the end of the day, there is no fact issue as the right of control. The summary judgment entered by Judge Cosby in this case in January of 2021 was proper and should be affirmed. The undisputed evidence is a matter of law established that WTech controlled the details of Plaintiff Grant's work, that Plaintiff Grant was WTech's employee, and that WTech had a valid workers' compensation policy.
Let me ask you, Mr. Pruitt. I understand that WTech did an investigation after this accident and determined that there was negligence at its workplace. Was Mr. Grant provided any information about how to file a workers' comp claim?
There's no evidence in the record of that, Your Honor.
Would a temporary employee sent by a staffing agent ordinarily, I mean, not that it's necessarily here or there, I'm just curious whether WTech would normally provide any employee, temporary or not, information about its workers' comp coverage?
Well, again, there's no evidence in the record of that, and so okay. I can't really speak okay. to that. But
sure.
The bottom line is that summary evidence shows that WTech has summary judgment evidence that it had a valid workers' compensation policy in a place that covered this gentleman and that he had the right to file a workers' compensation claim. Therefore, the workers' compensation should bar any direct action against WTech. And for those reasons, this is, as I've said two or three times, this case is very similar to all the Supreme Court cases cited, very similar to the April 2021 case of Waste Management versus Stevenson. And we asked the court to affirm the lower court's granting of the summary judgment that Judge Cosby granted back in January. Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to first off correct the statement made by appellant counsel regarding the workers' compensation situation in the Waste Management case. In that case, Waste Management was a non-subscriber to the Workers' Compensation Act. That's how Stevenson sued Waste Management in that case and the other employee that ran over his foot. In that case, he received workers' comp benefits from the staffing agency and sued Waste Management under common law. That's the issue that got taken up, and that's where the Supreme Court, in reiterating the law in the state of Texas, said that Waste Management controlled the daily activities related to the incident, and because that, they were the immediate employer, and as such, the individual had received workers' comp benefits, that there was no claim could be made against Waste Management. Aero Personnel is, as the court knows, an employee staffing company. The contractual relationship between them and WTEC indicates that WTEC is to provide supervision, training, and a safe workplace. The difference between this case and the Farley case relied upon by appellant in 1975 was, in that case, Farley was the only entity that controlled the premises. That's not how you have a situation like that now. You have a situation where you have a staffing agency providing employees to companies that take on the role of providing them training, supervision, et cetera. The court noted, in a very important question, there's no way Aero could train individuals to do any work for companies that it provides employees to, because they don't know what type of necessarily work details they are going to go into. And I would say that it'd probably be more dangerous to provide someone improper training, generic, that's not specific to the type of work that individual is going to go to when they go to the specific business, who then provides them the specific training for the work that those individuals are going to do. Your Honor, again, there is no evidence at all that Aero had in any way control, either actual or the right of control, to this argument. Appellant counsel continues to argue that there's some non-delegable duty out there to instruct and train and supervise. The problem is, Your Honor, in a case that is exactly on point as cited in our brief on page 8, the Brooks versus National Convenience Store case, which is a non-subscriber case, clearly holds that for a long understood example, an employer cannot have a duty to provide a safe workplace when it does not control the safety of the workplace. And Your Honor, that case came down in 1995 from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, and it holds law to this day. How can Aero, as a non-subscriber employer, have any duty to provide a safe workplace when it doesn't control the duty? We are bound contractually from not even being on the premises. We could not provide a supervisor at that facility. And secondly, how would a supervisor from Aero Personnel Temporary Agency know anything about what WTEC does to supervise properly? So the court asked if there was any case law on that issue, and of course there's not, because it wouldn't make sense. It would not make sense for a staffing agency to send someone to supervise over a business or industry they know nothing about. It is undisputed, Your Honor, that the only Aero Personnel individual employed by the staffing agency there at WTEC at the time of the incident was the plaintiff. It is also understood and undisputed that WTEC has admitted that they did provide supervision and training. The conclusionary statement that's relied upon by appellant was properly struck by Judge Crosby, as well as two other conclusionary statements that we believe is proper for them to not only strike because they're conclusionary, but because the facts show that they are factually not correct statements. Secondly, Your Honor, we argue that even if you assume that we owed some type of legal duty, which the National Convenience Store says we don't, where's the negligence? What did Aero do negligently relating to this incident? We weren't there. We didn't drive the forklift that caused the beam to fall and strike Mr. Grant. None of our employees did anything wrong or to cause this incident. Also, there's no evidence to indicate that even if Aero had a supervisor there or trained Mr. Grant in some elementary capacity that they say we should do, that would have prevented this incident from occurring. Finally, Your Honor, there's no evidence of proximate cause. We've also raised that in our summary judgment motion, which was implicitly granted by Judge Crosby. There's no evidence that our negligence, if any, was a proximate cause of this incident. Again, no evidence we did anything wrong, in causing this incident or otherwise. A couple other side issues, Your Honors, that we raise is that there's no evidence or no negligence per se allegation. I think that's pretty clear in the case law and the statute by OSHA, that OSHA states itself that an OSHA violation of OSHA regulation does not in any way impute a private cause of action. We raise that again. Arrow didn't violate any OSHA standard because we didn't control the premises or have anything to do with running of their operation. Your Honor, I was a briefing attorney in 1987 for Chief Justice Curtis Brown, the 14th Court of Appeals, and I asked him what his advice is to any appellate lawyer, and he says, well, when you're done talking, sit down. So I'm going to do that, unless that court has any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few brief points on rebuttal. First, Justice Walk, to your earlier question about Wingfoot and whether there was a contractual agreement, at least in looking back at the case while I was sitting there, there didn't say that there was, and there didn't say that it wasn't. They just said that there was an agreement that the staffing agency was responsible for all aspects of hiring, screening, and terminating employees since. So there's nothing as to one way or the other definitive on that. So I just want to be clear as to that. Another clarification as to Waste Management versus Stevenson. He said that Waste Management's a non-subscriber. This is a direct quote from Stevenson at the first page of the opinion, 622 Southwest 3rd at 276. Both Waste Management and Taylor Smith, the staffing agency, carried workers' compensation for their employees. Again, this is it's a different situation than here. Counsel for Arrow was discussing how there's no way they could train, but again, in Wingfoot, the staffing agency did provide training. And as I, Justice Walk, as we were discussing this, again, I've never said that they have to train specifically as to the task, but they can provide some general workplace safety training.
So what evidence is there that there would be some type of training which should have been provided, which would even have touched this situation?
I apologize if I don't fully understand your question.
This action happened in a specific way under a specific activity. What general training is there? What evidence is there is that some general training would have touched this situation and would have resulted in the accident not happening?
Sure. So, 2 points. First is that just based on the record and what the record evidence is as to training, it's that there was none. If we're just talking hypothetically in terms of what training could be done, you could just have general training as to in workplace safety in an industrial site like WTECs. Again, we're not talking about the specific harm that befell Mr. Grant. And that actually kind of dovetails with the point of that there's no proof of proximate causation. There is genuine issues of material fact as to proximate causation. We pointed to the dual nexuses here, and the key nexus here is there a nexus between Arrow's actions or inactions and the event? Well, but for Arrow sending an untrained Mr. Grant into an unsafe workplace, this never occurs. And if we're thinking about
that's where it gets circular, is what evidence is there that some general training that he might have received from Arrow would have averted this outcome?
The honest answer, Justice Walk, is I don't know, because there was nothing provided. There was nothing provided here. And separately from training, there's the independent duty to supervise. I mean, what I've heard and the point that I was earlier trying to make is that essentially what Arrow is saying is, well, once we send them to WTECH, because WTECH alone, we've contracted, we've said you have to train, you have to supervise, you have to do everything, that they get to wash their hands of their employee.
And why shouldn't that be the case?
Well, because they are, at the end of the day, Arrow is Mr. Grant's employer. This is a joint employment situation in which they owe certain non-delegable duties to Mr. Grant. And so, yes, while WTEC may have more specific duties, so does Arrow. Arrow's at the end of the – Mr. Grant's not working for WTEC. He's not a WTEC employee. He's loaned to WTEC from Arrow. I said my time is up. We ask that you reverse and remand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. We're glad that you were here to join us, and it's been helpful. Your case has now been submitted, and you are free to go.
Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas.